Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
On today's show, author Christoph Borgak joins me to discuss his brand new graphic novel, Under Kingdom. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I feel more comfortable being over the top on Big Squid. Welcome to the show today. We have a wonderful chat with author Christoph Borgak discussing his graphic novel, Under Kingdom. Before we bring Christoph in, a couple of quick plugs. I'm performing in Canberra this Wednesday at the Canberra Comedy Club. If you're in the area and free, I'd love to see you there. That's Wednesday, the 3rd of May in Canberra, in case you're listening to this podcast 3 years from now and wonder where I am. When you sign up for the Big Squid Patreon, you have an episode dedicated to you. And today's shout out goes to Jess Marwini. Thank you for being a supporter, Jess. I hope you enjoy this delightful chat with the young author. And Jess, keep an eye out for a new Patreon-only podcast that's dropping this week. It's an interview with Ronnie Chang from 2013 on my original podcast, Can You Take This Photo, Please? It's a great chat with the fantastic young comedian before he became the worldwide success he is today. You'll be able to access that later this week, Jess. Over at Patreon, there's a lot of bonus content, including interviews with Tom Gleason, Will Anderson, Cal Wilson. They're all from Can You Take This Photo, Please? As well. And there's all sorts of other podcasts as well, including audio blogs and works in progress. If you'd like to sign up for this and more, head to patreon.com/Justin Hamilton and you'll find a tier that suits you. I'll swing by at the end to discuss what's coming up, but in the meantime, let's bring in Christoph. We were just having a bit of a chat before we got into the recording of this podcast. Long-time listeners of the Big Squid podcast know that often there's been like a half-hour chat before the recording actually begins. And I'm throwing this from left to centre for you, Christoph, which is I was very lucky as a kid to be reading comics at a young age where suddenly there was this guy from England called Alan Moore who was writing Swamp Thing. And then that made me keep an eye out for what was coming out, things like, and then suddenly it was Watchmen. And I was there for that kind of start of, you know, where we are now, which is graphic novels are for grown-ups, you know, that kind of thing. Recently, I don't know if you've read it, but I read his novella, What We Can Know About Thunderman. And it has kind of, it's like Alan Moore brought me into the world of comics, and then I feel like he's doing his best to push me out of the world of comics. And what I had to remember was, it's not comics. I think I'm kind of done with superhero comics, but I still really enjoy original stuff, like your work, Brubaker and Phillips, you know, like the medium is still great. And I was wondering, since we're talking comics, let's really get into a very comic book kind of question, which is, what's your secret origin?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about this in terms of, like, not going into deep. But interesting, you talk about finding sort of comics as a kid. I didn't find them till I was sort of almost 20.
Right.
So I was brought up Seventh-day Adventist, which is quite a conservative sort of, I guess, look, it was a cult up until the 70s, but it's essentially a fairly conservative Christian denomination. And a lot of the media I had access to as a kid was quite limited, both a little bit from my parents, but honestly a lot from myself in terms of, you know, I think a lot of conservative religions kind of teach you to self-censor and self-monitor the media you consume. So I didn't really start actually like engaging with mainstream pop culture really until kind of I was in my 20s.
Great.
And, you know, and I think it was sort of 2009 when I was 19, I started reading, I watched all the X-Men films and was like, oh, I want more of this. So I started reading comics and that kind of, and then from there I would just read X-Men comics and then Marvel comics. And then it kind of branched out until I was sort of went to the evolution, you know, that you're at now where you kind of follow creators and creative teams.
Yes. Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? Because it means you came to the medium without really any preconceptions. And I feel like there would be a lot of people out there now who their first encounter with these kinds of now mainstream characters is through movies or TV. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And I mean, that's, you know, I think that's ultimately, you know, I have mixed feelings about that. And I don't know if you've talked to, I believe your friend with Siobhan, who I know isn't a huge fan of the movies, you know, and sort of struggles with the way a lot of the time it feels like it sort of, particularly with the Marvel stuff, takes from the comics but never really gives back.
Right, right. There's something that I feel like what's happened, and look, this is just my perspective. Like, if people still enjoy them, I totally get it. But from my side of things, it is there seems to be a lack of creativity, and it feels very much like they make the movies the way they used to make the comics in the 60s, where it's like Kevin Feige is Stan Lee, he's saying this is what we need to do, and then you send it off. Back then you'd send off the artist like Ditko or Kirby or that to draw it up, and then he'd come and add dialogue. And this, you send it off to a bigger team, of course. They create the movie. But what it means is it's homogenized and everything kind of hits a similar beat. And I want more experimentation. I want, you know, I've banged on about this on the podcast as well, but the difference between Everything Everywhere All at Once playing with the multiverse and Doctor Strange is light years apart, and Doctor Strange has what, four times bigger budget, and you get half a second of Paint World, and you go, no, go back to Paint World. I want to be in Paint World. So, was it mind blowing for you as a young fella to be watching the X-Men movies and then go back and read the comics and go, wait a minute, Wolverine's 5'3"?
There was some of that. I think what kind of hit me, you know, was just how like insanely complex everything is. And I don't want to say convoluted, but like because of the, you know, the amount of, particularly X-Men, the amount of characters and the amount of
history
with that group of heroes, it's just, it can be quite overwhelming. And I think the one good thing that the movies do, for the most part, is kind of synthesize and simplify a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because I remember when I was getting into comics, I probably spent a couple of hours researching, like, where do I start? Like, it's quite, you know, and I was lucky enough that, you know, the run I was recommended kind of clicked for me, you know, and it was all good, but it could have easily gone another way.
Can I ask what that run was?
Yes, yeah. The reason I didn't bring it up is I have a weird... It was Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men run.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, is obviously a lot of it has come out about Joss since I read that run. So I don't think I could go back and read it now, but at the time it really connected with me.
Look, it's regardless of the person and what we know about him now, that run is actually a perfect jumping on point because it's coming through, it's coming out of the Grant Morrison period where he completely revolutionized how the X-Men stories were told. I think he was the first person to kind of almost use mutants as African-American culture and the way people are trying to glom onto and appropriate aspects of it and all these kinds of interesting ideas. And then, you know what Marvel's like, it's all about the status quo. So then they were like, right, we need to get back to costumes and we need to get back to simple storytelling that you can get people involved. And that's a pretty good run, and it's got all that beautiful John Cassaday artwork as well.
The art's stunning, and, you know, it's a small cast, and it's very kind of focused on the relationships between the cast really played front and center, which I think really, just kind of made it really accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, there were, like, you know, some of the high concept stuff with, you know, Breakworld and Cassandra Nova and all that, but the actual kind of heart of the comic was very, very grounded.
Yeah, it really was. So just getting back to, you know, you were brought up Seventh-day Adventist. So how did you, and you, what you said is really interesting. I think a lot of people don't realize this, but there is a lot of self-censoring. There is a lot of, I can't do that, or not even, I can't do that. I have no interest in that because this is who I am. So how did X-Men slip through the cracks?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, so just for, I guess, a timeline reference, I deconverted when I was about 21, but I sort of found X-Men when I was 19. So it was still, you know, I think there's something universal about X-Men. I think, you know, like, as cliched as it, everyone's felt like an outcast at some point. And, you know, this is, it's interesting, because particularly with modern, funnily enough, without going into it, you know, too much, but with a lot of modern Christianity, or particularly, you know, the more kind of extreme versions of it, there is a real feeling of being an outcast. And even though, you know, in many ways it's the dominant culture, you know, those people often feel like and talk about themselves as if they're the underdog. So I imagine it was maybe part of that as well that kind of, you know, connected me to the X-Men at the time. And now obviously my relationship with it is very different. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think the X-Men just appeals to everyone, you know, regardless of your political affiliations.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because even the one of the fascinating things about, I think, the way left and right culture interact with each other is that I feel like on the left, that's where a lot of the innovations and breakthroughs happen in life, and then the right appropriates them and you know, so once upon a time, like on a very, you know, superficial level, it was grunge music in the 90s and the guys, you know, in those bands and girls in those bands wearing, you know, denim jackets and everything, because where they performed in Seattle was cold. And then 2 years later, when grunge is massive, you've got models in Milan on the catwalk wearing $200,000 denim jackets, you know. So taking that back to what you were talking about, feeling like an outsider, like, that's what we've just witnessed and still witnessing in American politics, where the right wing, like the militant right wing, I should say, under Trump and all of those, are all talking about how they're the underdog, and you're
100%, even though they control the levers of power. But I think, I think there's something about feeling like the underdog that people will always kind of connect to and try and be, I think, to an extent, even if it's not factually at all accurate.
Yeah, it's so funny, isn't it? It's like, it's just a lot of people yelling at each other, going, no, I've had it worse. No, I've had it worse. And trying to talk themselves down to talk themselves up. So, you know, I really enjoyed Under Kingdom. And what I'm curious about then is if you weren't reading comics at a young age, what were your early inspirations?
Yeah, look, not, there's two kind of key inspirations that probably sound a bit odd at each other. The first wouldn't be surprising given, you know, what I was talking about earlier about sort of being quite strict about the media I'd access to, but the Narnia books were kind of, you know, my entry into fantasy and were kind of, you know, a huge part of my childhood and a huge part of kind of me exploring reading and the fantasy genre. And I have very mixed feelings towards Narnia today. for a lot of obvious reasons.
But you know, when you I read them as a kid as well. Like, I had no idea what the parables were. Like, I was just like, Aslan's a lion.
So the Narnia books, and the other kind of one of the few kind of pieces of media that I did act that I was very into as a kid was The Simpsons. You know, as it was for a lot of people in my generation. Specifically, the funny thing about The Simpsons is I feel like everyone you kind of talk to, you know, obviously everyone reveres seasons 1 to 10, but for me, it was I didn't really get into it till 2002. So I've seen some of the older seasons, but like I haven't seen the monorail episode. I haven't seen a bunch of like the classic early episodes. For me, my seasons are like 10, anywhere between 10 to 20. It's kind of, I know all those episodes really well. That yeah, so that was the other big inspiration, you know. One of the many things I love about The Simpsons is joke density. You know, in terms of every second thing someone says is a joke. Every time you like freeze the frame, you'll find some sort of joke, whether it's on a sign or a shop or something. And I just love that. You know, the idea that like it rewards you for paying attention. And it also, to me, this kind of this accessibility of, well, if that joke offends you or you don't like that joke, that's fine. We'll have another one in a few seconds for you.
Right. It also takes the pressure off the jokes as well. I talk about this with young comedians who one of the best things you can do in a stand-up routine is have a little joke that helps you get from A to C. You know, you just put it right in the middle there, and it's almost an aside. It's not something that you stop on for a kind of big laugh. It's just something that is amusing that helps you get to the punchline, which also then takes a little bit of pressure off the punchline because they're already having a good time on the way. The longer you go without a joke, the more it's like, fuck, this better pay off, right?
Totally. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And now that you mention it, there are heaps of jokes in this. Like, you know, that correlation to The Simpsons does come through in the work because there's stacks of jokes. Like, there's just, and we'll get more into the breakdown of some of the stuff that you're doing in the graphic novel. But there's whole panels that I reckon, especially the where you're describing what characters are like.
Yeah.
It's joke after joke after joke, but there are also character beats as well. So I can really see that in your work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, that was, you know, I looked back and I actually, part of it was like, did I cram too many in? But I definitely just, any funny idea I had, I just whacked it in there. Yeah, and I think that was very much kind of chasing that, that Simpsons vibe of like, I just want you to feel like there's good value for money joke-wise. And yeah, the idea that like, if this doesn't kind of, enough jokes that like, something is going to really connect with you. You know, five might not hit, but, you know, one hopefully will.
Yeah, I think you have a much bigger strike rate than that, but
thank you. But
I understand the way to go into it, and also, you know, like I know a lot of old farts like myself, and they do bang on about The Simpsons going, oh, you know what, I just stopped watching after season six, and you know they should have stopped there, but if they'd stopped there, then you know your generation may have missed it.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, a good friend of mine, an amazing artist in England, Beck Kubrick, had just finished watching every season of The Simpsons.
Goodness.
And like, liked a bunch of the later stuff that I haven't really messed with yet, you know? I think that show is just, it's probably going to be on forever, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah. It's funny. Sometimes, even if a series kind of has hit its peak, if it still maintains a level of excellence, you really take it for granted. I'm a little bit like that with South Park. I never think to watch South Park. And then sometimes one of my friends will say, hey, you have to watch this episode.
Yeah.
I'll watch it. And I'll laugh my ass off. And I think it's honestly one of the funniest things I've seen in ages. And then I honestly just don't think to get back to it for ages. And it's not, it's because it's a part of everyday life to such an extent that it doesn't end up becoming appointment viewing.
Totally, yeah. It's an embarrassment of riches scenario.
Yeah. I forgot to check just before. Marie Enger, is that their name?
Enger.
How did you meet and how did you work together? Because her artwork it's really dynamic. Like, it's really got a kinetic energy to it, and you know, you go between the panels so beautifully. You know exactly where to go. How did you meet, and how did you kind of create this world together?
Totally. I mean, yeah, the first thing I'll say about Marie's art and working with them, every writer who's worked with Marie, I think, figures out that the kind of key word with Marie is energy. You know, they bring so much energy to the page. So, and, you know, if you, and they will obviously, every panel, they want to give it their all in terms of backgrounds and detail and energy. So a lot of my job was to kind of be like, hey, Marie, you don't have to do a background there. You can just do the character. It looks great. Let's, you know, you don't have to do more work.
Right.
Yeah. So a lot of that was kind of, I think a lot of my job was like, no, this is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, and helping them hold back because they're just,
Did she do that with you with the jokes? Did she say, hey?
No, but there was definitely a bit of like, particularly when I was writing the Mothman character. Initially, he talks in the original script, and then Marie just one day was like, to me, Mothman doesn't talk. And I was like, all right. I nodded, and then that was it. That was like the end of the discussion, and then I just rewrote it. So there was definitely like a back and forth of like, a lot of the characters like that appeared in the book were just based off like designs Marie had already done. I'd be like, hey, who's this guy? Or they would send me pictures. That's how Lemon the Dragon became a thing. They sent me a picture of Lemon with like, this is Lemon. He's got wings on his butt. I'm like, cool. He's in the book now. So that was kind of a big part of it. And just coming back to how we met. So in 2018, I went to my first US convention, Emerald City in Seattle. And I'd been a fan of Marie's stuff and sort of seen their stuff online. And they were tabling. And at the time, they put out this zine called Punks Win, where they'd illustrated a bunch of like punk songs. And turned them into comics, and a few of the bands we both really liked. So we kind of vibed on that, hung out a bunch at the con, and then maybe six months later, they kind of messaged me being like, hey, this publisher wants me to reach it to send them a pitch, you know, that they want like a middle grade thing. I don't have any ideas. Do you have anything? And we kind of, you know, what I brought them was the very bare bones of Underkingdom, and we just kind of went back and forth. And a lot of kind of what we talked about was we were both big fans of the Netflix kids show Troll Hunters,
right?
Which is the Guillermo del Toro one, and a lot of it was kind of our riff on that.
Right. Or like,
here's what we liked about the show. Here's the direction we would have gone in if we were in control. So rather than being like, oh, they did this wrong, it was more like, hey, it would be cool if we took this stuff from the show and went in and zigged where it zagged.
You know, that is a really good lesson for people listening, which is if you're watching a TV series and you love it, and but then you get frustrated because it goes in a different direction, create your version.
Totally. Oh, me. And sometimes it's not even, you know, especially with Trollhunter's Breath, it wasn't even frustration. It was more just like, it would be interesting if they did a different part.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of, you know, and this is something Marie and I had discussed before working on Underkingdom, is the idea that like a lot of boys media, particularly the stuff I grew up with all, and Trollhunters is the example, this is all kind of violence or combat focus.
Yeah.
You know, the character has to learn how to fight or do some sort of physical thing. And, you know, that's what happens with Trollhunters. And we were like, well, what if it's the opposite? You know, what if it's, you know, the world is pushing this character towards violence and towards combat, and ultimately he finds a workaround. And that's kind of where, what Underkingdom is about, and kind of when we stumbled upon like the heart of the book.
Yeah, right. That's interesting because the character of Shay, who is our lead character, is a pacifist and doesn't want to be engaging in that kind of stuff. So, and it's interesting, like one of my favorite parts, which turns up pretty early in the graphic novel, is with Ed, and Ed's getting picked on. And it's great because you have Shay off panel and Shay's talking to the bullies and talking them through what they could be doing instead. And at first you think, geez, this sounds a bit harsh. And then you realize what he's done is he's convinced these bullies to go off and leave Ed alone.
Yeah.
And that's a real, that's a really important character beat for the character.
Yeah. 100%.
You really get your head around him.
Yeah. I think right from the beginning, we kind of wanted to show you who Shay was. This is his deal, you know, so that when he kind of finds out about the Underkingdom, which is a kingdom of monsters but below his town, we kind of know that what they want from him, which is to be a warrior, is not who he is and not what he does.
Yeah, and that's interesting as well, because I think a lot of young people go through the expectations of what their family want, what their family expect. I guess, maybe I'm drawing a long bow here, but, you know, after you telling me you grew up in a Seventh-day Adventist house, you know, and then moving away from that and finding other parts of the world out there, there's a little bit more of Shay in you than I probably would have realized to begin with. Is that fair?
Look, I think so. I think a lot of the stuff I do, when I'm writing for the kids or young adults, I'm finding a lot of what I do kind of deals with the conflict of what can you take from childhood and what do you kind of leave behind. And I think for me, Shay is a great example of, like, you know, I think it, you know, as children, and particularly, you know, in its simplest, uncomplicated form, a lot of what I was taught, you know, around Christianity was about love and compassion and empathy. And then as you get older, it gets more complicated, you know, because empathy is only extended for certain people, you know, and suddenly you find out that it's not really about love and empathy, but it's kind of trying to take that simplicity and that simple understanding of that I had as a child and be like, hey, it's actually okay to hold on to this, you know, and then how do you navigate the world with it? So that's kind of, So I definitely think, you know, again, I want Shay to be a universal character, but there's a lot of me there, I think.
Yeah, but I think having that aspect of you, which is it's a unique experience for you, but it's also something that people can relate to, and I think that's why that, you know, as I said, that's why really early on I'm on Shay's side, and it came down very early from that scene because I was
glad.
Yeah, because it's, you know, you can see Shay thinking through the problem, and it's clever. Like, you know, he really uses their biases against them to help out his friend, and that's great.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's kind of where, I guess, the kind of adult aspect came into it, in terms of like Shay is kind, but he's also pragmatic.
Yeah.
You know, he also understands that sometimes you have to appeal to people's worst nature to get ultimately what you want, which is a peaceful outcome.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's kind of the maturity I wanted to bring to the perspective outside of, like, oh, be kind to everyone and they'll be kind to you, because that's not how the world works.
No.
You know, the idea that, hey, you can navigate the world with kindness, you've just got to be pragmatic about it.
Yeah, and sometimes you can just not only use what you have at your disposal, but you can use, in this case, it's the intellectual weapons of bullying.
Yeah,
and invert them in a way that, you know, the bullies go off. Like, in a weird way, I don't like those characters, but in a weird way, they were so easily manipulated. I found a part of them like, oh, you idiots. And it kind of took the edge off them a bit too.
I'm a big fan. One of my favorite tropes in a lot of kids' media is just like the dumb school bully trope is so much fun to play with.
Yeah. 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 And it's really fun.
Yeah. And it kind of never gets old.
No. And, you know, we've all had that. We've all had that encounter with
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With the dumb bully, you know, and you could easily win them over as well.
Yeah, 100%. They're kind of easily outmaneuvered, but you just don't always have maybe the the patience or the skills to do it as a kid.
Yeah, yeah. When I was younger, I was very lucky. I had a pretty bully-free time in primary school and high school. I think it's one of the things which I didn't realize until why that was so. Because, you know, I was a small kid, you know, I was pretty short. A friend of mine said it's because I played basketball. And because I played basketball and I was short, I had to carry myself bigger on, to be able to compete. And he said, what you don't realize is even though, you know, you're a short ass, you don't think of yourself as short. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, I know I'm short, but if you said name, 20 attributes of you off the top of your head from, to positive to negative, someone would say, you're short. And I'd go, oh, yes, and I'm short. But they're things that you, I kind of think of, bullies back in the day, and I was, I would get around them. I guess this is, now that we're talking it out loud, that's what appealed about that scene was because it was through, kind of holding myself in a different standard, but I was also pretty funny as a kid as well, and it's amazing how humor gets you out of trouble.
Goes such a long way. It's such a good defense mechanism.
Yeah, you can make someone laugh, and they're they're like, you know, even on the most basic level, they're like, oh yeah, well I was going to beat you up, but fuck, you're funny, and you go, yeah, great, we're good, let's keep going. But it's interesting what you're talking about with Shay, and you were talking about the storytelling and some of the tropes, like the the dumbass bully that you can turn the tables on. What's interesting in this as well, there are some classic storytelling tropes, like having to go to school and juggle this responsibility. That's classic stuff, which is great. But then you're also pushing against some of the tropes, like very early on, we learned that the monsters are the people that, were picked on and driven away by society and by, who we would normally side with. So how did you and Marie work out which tropes to lean into and which tropes to explore and change?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, when writing stuff for younger people, the first, at least for me, I find there's always a balance between nostalgia and pushing forward,
Yes.
And I think you can't write for kids without nostalgia. You need to empathize with what you liked as a kid, with what you were interested in, with the way it felt to be a kid. I think you just can't write effectively for kids if you don't do that. But then on the flip side, you can get stuck in that rut where you just recreate the media you liked at that time without kind of thinking about what about it appealed and how you can translate it for a modern day audience. A great example of this is like in indie comics, there are so many Ninja Turtles ripoffs all by guys in their mid to late 30s because they love Ninja Turtles, so they just make their own version of it. But there's a difference between recreating and actually deconstructing, so a lot of the tropes we went with were tropes that really resonated. The Chosen One trope is such, as a kid, I think it's so important that kids feel like, not necessarily special, but that they have agency and what they do matters and that there is a part for them to play, so that trope to me is so important. With the monsters, again, I think it's the underdog thing.
Yeah.
I don't think the book maybe would work if the monsters were, obviously, we can't, they're monsters, so that sometimes their intentions or the way they do things are kind of weird, or strange, or come across as, aggressive, but at the end of the day, they kind of need to be likable. And it's interesting, I was thinking about where that kind of, I guess, that approach came from. And I was very, another one of the kind of touch points I had for pop culture growing up was Warhammer. So I still, Warhammer Fantasy was a big part of my late childhood and is still something I do today. And one of my favorite things about kind of Warhammer is, as fantasy, is kind of crazy. Every fantasy idea is in Warhammer, pretty much.
Yeah.
But because they basically, the lore and the stories exist to make you buy the little models that you paint, it means that all kind of the factions, including the evil ones, have stories and will have novels about their characters. And also, it kind of forces you to empathize with like a goblin or like a you know, a demon worshipping mass murderer, or like these insane characters. And I think that's kind of what I liked about Under Kingdom, is like the idea that monsters more or less represent like just an exaggerated part of humanity, or, you know, a human element taken to the extreme. So it was about making that kind of relatable, and not necessarily so you, you know, can excuse them, but you understand why they, what they do and why they do it in their worldview.
Yeah, well, that's getting to the heart of xenophobia, isn't it? Is the fear of the unknown, and what you're allowing these monsters to be is, you know, you get where what's making them tick, and then, but also there's such a broad range of monsters as well. Like some of them, you know, quite grotesque, and some of them are borderline cuddly. You know,
yeah, 100%. And I mean, Marie and I kind of pulled from everywhere in terms of, you know, so Marie is big into like cryptid. So that was, you know, they kind of get advised a lot of the cryptid stuff.
Right.
I used to devour mythology as a kid, so there's a lot of kind of world mythology, bit of D&D stuff thrown in there. And then the other kind of element that Marie and I both kind of had in common was just the love of nature and animals. And that was kind of, particularly with the imps. I mean, imps are parrots, essentially.
Yes.
You know, in this book, you know, Marie had three cockatiels that kind of run her life, and they all played very heavy inspiration for the imps, and just, you know, the idea that this tiny creature that's like way smarter than it should be for its size, and just isn't quite smart enough to like use its brain to do anything constructive.
Right. You know, one of the, I know it's weird to talk about, but one of the genuine joys of the first major lockdown that we experienced was because there was so little stimulation going on in the world. And where I live in Surrey Hills, you know, I live on Elizabeth Street, which, as you know, is a pretty busy street normally.
Yeah.
And because there was so little traffic, all the birds came back. Like, all the birds were just living out there. And, like, I even had a day where I walked out to, you know, do my shopping, and there was, like, an ibis, like three crows, a couple of pigeons, all eating a squashed rat on the middle of the street. And they all looked at me as if to say, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, this is our place now. And the way they looked at me was so entertaining. It's kind of ignited this love of birds now. Like, I've always appreciated birds, but now I'm really into their little personalities and the way they conduct themselves.
That's the wonderful thing about like animals when they reach like a certain level of intelligence. They just kind of develop an undeniable personality. I have two cats, and they are both, you know, dumb as bricks, but also such distinct personalities that I you know, every cat I meet, I'm like, what's your deal? You know, birds are so similar, you know, in that way as well.
Yeah, what are your secret thoughts? What are those conversations that you're having together, you cheeky little buggers? Can we talk about Sabelle?
I would love that.
Sabelle is, how would you just, like, she's like the auntie, but she's also many things. At one point, she was an imaginary child to Shay. Like, where did Sabelle come from?
Yeah, I mean, Sabelle is kind of pure chaos. Fun, is this fun, chaotic energy. And she's really inspired by, you know, something else that was a big inspiration on Under Kingdom was the cartoon Gravity Falls.
Right.
Which kind of came out, I think, like 2014 for Disney, and kind of paved the way in terms of, like, it's a cartoon for kids, and it kind of deals a lot with, like, cryptids and conspiracy theories and stuff. But it's, like, genuinely hilarious.
Right.
And a lot of the humor is very dark, for children. And it kind of, I think, just kind of, for a lot of people, myself included, just kind of changed what cartoons for kids could be.
Right.
In terms of, like, you can deal with big stuff. You can have, like, you can actually have really dark humor whilst also making it appropriate for kids.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we kind of loved about that show is one of the characters, Grunkle Stan, who's the two main characters, Mabel and Dipper's great uncle, is essentially, like, a con man and a criminal.
Yeah.
Like, the opening sequence of the show features him, like, running with a cash register. Like, there's no, you know, and he, like, runs this thing called the Mystery Shack, which is essentially, like, full of, like, fake cryptids that he's made and like all the, you know, and he's just like a hustler essentially. So he kind of opened up the idea that like, oh, a character can be like, you can have a character be good, but also like chaotic and not like, not a piece of shit necessarily, but just like, for Sibel certain reason, but she's like, certainly not like a lawful person and certainly quite chaotic in the, and messy in the way she kind of does life. Yeah. And a lot of that is, you know, the fact that she can turn into anyone because she's a changeling. And in this world in particular, she has the power where she can kind of, anyone she can think of, she can turn into.
Yeah.
Whereas most changelings can only copy what already exists. So she kind of creates all these different characters to help her get out of trouble or, you know, or just because she wants to and then tends to lose track of them.
Yeah, great. And it's also, you know, it's another lesson for kids as well, which is like, how many times do you have a friend or do you meet someone else's friend and on the surface you think, why are you friends with that person? Because they have this, this and this that is quite clearly shonky about them.
Totally.
But within the confines and the relationship itself, there's so many other things going on. It's so much more complex. And so, like, you know, you can still have someone that you adore as a friend for decades that you probably wouldn't trust them around your girlfriend.
I think for me it's also that idea that, like, because I think as a kid you're really black and white, so a lot of the time morality and kind of obeying the law or, you know, conforming with ideas of politeness is, you know, is, oh, that's what a good person is. So I think it's important, particularly, you know, as in 2023 where, you know, laws and legislation don't necessarily relate to what is ethically good, particularly, you know, the US again being a pretty extreme example of that.
Yeah.
Some stuff going on over there. You know, I think it's important for kids to be able to trust their own sense of like, oh no, like I know what a good person is.
Yeah.
I don't need someone else or, like, whether they conform to this idea of, you know, niceness to be whether they're actually a good person or not. I can inherently tell.
Yeah. And Sibel is perfect for that. What a delightful character. One of the other things that I loved about the way you told the story is you have the explanation panels for the various monsters. So you'll be, for everyone listening, you're reading and then it's it just kind of stops and you will get an image of a monster and then it's you get all these facts about them. And it, for me, it was a cross between Dungeons and Dragons, but I'm guessing it's more 100%. Warhammer a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, D&D is a pretty good example, but like, you know, sort of like I used to read a bunch of like fact books as a kid, so it's kind of like that as well, like kind of like a nature book or like a animal encyclopedia mixed with like a D&D monster manual.
And also for me, I don't know if you've ever seen these because they would have come out before you were into comics, but there was the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, which was literally issues of comics which would have like a picture of Captain America and then they would summarize their whole history and their first appearance and that, and it would be everything from, you know, your main characters like, you know, the Fantastic Four, etc., to, you know, weird-ass characters like Blue Diamond, who only ever appeared in a few issues, and or Sabre and characters like that. And that's part of what appealed to me because it felt like I was getting little guidebooks as I went through the story.
Yeah, and no, that was very deliberate. And I haven't read any of the Marvel ones. I've read, like, when I was trying to get into Valiant comics, I read a bunch of, like, the Valiant ones where it's the same thing. It's kind of super condensed information, which is, you know, that was, I did them because they were fun, but also the less interesting reason of, you know, we had a pretty tight page count of 88 pages.
Yeah.
So it was a real good way to just kind of do a fun info dump and accelerate the story along the way that kind of felt fun and unique to the book.
Yeah, I think they really work. I think they were nice little breather spots as well. So you get it just kind of changes up the rhythm of what you're reading, and then it's like, whew, and then you get straight back into the story.
Totally, and hopefully create space. I mean, because, you know, 88 pages isn't, you know, super long, so we kind of wanted to do what we could to make the book feel big.
Yeah.
You know, bigger than it is.
Yeah, it makes the universe feel, well, it feels like I'm getting the tip of the iceberg, so which is great. There is a couple of other things that I just wanted to particularly ask you about. I love Chedball. For everyone listening, the bullies that I was talking about earlier, they play a game called Chedball, and when they describe it, it's essentially soccer.
I mean, there's nothing to me, like, there's a few things I always find funny, and one of them is when someone thinks they've invented something, but it clearly already exists.
Yes.
I just think that's so funny.
Is that a real-life experience? Because I've had that quite a few times where someone says something to you, and at the end of it, you go, that's a cheeseburger, mate.
Not so much real life. It's just like a comedy trope that's come up a bunch. So, like, this is such a specific pool, but I don't know if you ever watched the Australian show Review.
No.
Okay, there was like a trope there that where there was like a character that would always pitch movies, and they were just movies that already existed.
Right.
And then
right.
On I'm also a big fan of this podcast called Comedy Bang Bang.
Yep.
And there's a where comedians come on and do characters, and there's a character called Entrepreneur, and all he does is pitch ideas that already exist.
Right.
But of course, he goes to great lengths to kind of describe it. And then when the actual idea is brought up, he acts like he's never heard of it. And it's like, it's the same thing every time. But there's something inherently hilarious to me about that. Particularly like soccer, which is such a, you know, such like a big thing. The idea that this kid just has never heard of it and is convinced he's reinvented it. And then willing to die on the hill that he's reinvented it.
Oh, yeah.
Is again, characters willing to like die over the smallest stake is one of my favorite comedy
tropes. Well, that's one of the reasons why it will sound weird that I had this weird affection for these two bullies, but it was because they were willing to, as you said, die on the hill for something that's already been invented, and they were easily manipulated, and it was like, ah, those guys.
Totally, yeah. There's like a likability to kind of just how basic they are, I think.
It was great. I loved it. I don't want to give away too much because I want people to read the graphic novel, but Ed's life looks like it's starting to get a little bit of strain. The relationship with Ed is starting to look like it's getting a bit strained towards the end. Can you give us a hint of how Shay's going to move forward with this new responsibility and his everyday life?
I mean, I think, you know, what you have to do to make a book like Under Kingdom interesting, right? If you have to have the interplay between, you know, his two lives, so his life ruling the kingdom, you know, the Under Kingdom below town, and then his life above town. And for the most part, everyone important in his life, you know, Sabelle, Lemon, his mom, they're all connected to the underground world. You know, Ed is this link to the surface world, you know. So his relationship with Ed is so important, you know, and that's, you know, And there's definitely, you know, a bit of conflict in that relationship towards the end, and there'll definitely be that going forward. But ultimately, you know, it's going to be an ongoing relationship.
Yeah.
You know, their sort of friendship, and as it's sort of beginning to become something more, and they kind of navigate that. So, you know, that as they navigate that, that's going to be complicated by, you know, everything Shay's going through. And there's certainly, we're going to meet, you know, if we get to do more, you know, we're going to meet Ed's dad, who's further going to complicate things. And there's, we've definitely got designs, and that relationship is so key to the overall story. And we're really, you know, and hopefully, you know, if we do another book, we can actually focus on that a bit more. We tried to put in as much of Ed and Shay as we could, but I would have loved to do more in this book.
Yeah. So you have a rough idea of, if there will be like a certain number of graphic novels?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think with Under Kingdom, usually I'm pretty meticulously planned out, but with Under Kingdom, it was really, all right, this works as a starting point. And I think Marie and I are both kind of in the mindset that, you know, as long as we can be paid to do it, we want to make, you know, so that it's financially sustainable. We want to make these books. We both really, you know, Marie talks a lot about how a lot of what they do, funnily enough, is like horror. You know, their main kind of stuff they do are horror comics and fairly intense horror. You know, so for them, Under Kingdom is such a wonderful kind of respite from that, because it's just silly and dumb and just joyful, you know, and especially now I'm finding, you know, as I'm trying to break more into the adult comic market and do something a little bit, you know, darker, and I'm trying to do some horror projects, you know, Under Kingdom becomes so much more important because it's just this refuge of just joy and light. So we both just want to do it for, you know, for as long as we can. I mean, anywhere between kind of like 3 to 5 books, I'd be happy. But, you know, honestly, as long as I can make it work, I'd love to keep doing it.
You know, it'd be great to be in a situation like Saga, where Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples just come back with the next part of the story when they can. Or
totally,
that would be great. Or even Brubaker and Phillips. You know, they make. I think they produced 5 Reckless graphic novels in a row, and then their next one's something completely different. You know, so if you can keep coming back and feeding it, that'd be great.
Yeah, totally. You know, and I guess for both, you know, Vaughan and Brubaker, they're both kind of in the 1% of comic creators where they're just such, you know, undeniable names and talented. Yeah, they can kind of do that. I'm hoping, you know, that if the first book sells well and we're, you know, able to kind of make an impact, that we can do more. Yeah.
No, that'll be so good. Hey, I've got one final question for you. And, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but let's dream big. This gets made into a movie. So who would be your dream cast?
This is a dumb response. But essentially the only thing that Marie and I have discussed in stone is that Lemon has to have a New Zealand accent. So all dragons in the world of Under Kingdom have a New Zealand accent.
Great.
They are not from New Zealand. I want to make that very clear. They're not from New Zealand, but they all have a New Zealand accent.
Yeah, great.
So, like, the dream casting for him would be, honestly, probably, like, Rhys Darby would be, like, the dream, you know. And, Rhys Darby, Jermaine Clement. There's an amazing New Zealand comedian, Guy.
Guy Montgomery.
Yeah. I love Guy's voice, and he would also be, like, another pick as well.
One of the funniest people I know. I haven't seen Guy
just
in ages.
Just everything he says is just... the way he kind of enunciates and stuff just makes me laugh so much. And whenever I hear his voice, I'm like, oh, I just want to see your voice coming out of a silly, loopy dragon.
I want that as well. I used to produce a show down in Melbourne called The Shelf, and we had Guy on for a season. And one of the shows, it was during the comedy festival, and the classic talking to someone in the audience and taking their phone. And he ended up using that girl's phone to buy a ticket to his show.
Amazing.
And he was so charming, and everyone just sat there. Also, the girl's connection wasn't that great, and it was taking a little bit too long, and it still worked, and it was honestly one of the funniest things I've seen.
That's incredible. Oh, I love that so much. That's amazing. Guy Montgomery would be kind of like a Lemon, or another kind of dragon would be chef's kiss.
The way to go. All right, well, we'll have to introduce you to Guy. That's the next job.
Oh, I would love that. There's nothing like as a like a writer that I like more than like the thought of meeting comedians.
Right.
Just because I'm, you know, compared to like what I do where I'm just in front of a computer, you know, you guys go out in front of an audience, it seems so much cooler. So there's kind of like that, that like, oh my goodness, I get to meet a comedian.
Well, we can sort you out with that. We can make that happen. So, hey, Christoph, I really love the graphic novel. I loved Marie's work, so please pass on my best to them. When is the book being launched, and where are the best places for people to find it?
Yeah, so it's coming out on April 5th. So either you can ask your local comic shop, if you have one. So if you're in Sydney, King's is, you know, a wonderful comic shop, and they're going to be stocking Under Kingdom. It's also available to pre-order online. So if you just Google Under Kingdom comic pre-order, it'll come up. So you can do that through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble online, a bunch of different ways you can do it. Or you could also go to your local bookstore and ask if they can get you a copy as well, because it's going to be available through Penguin Random House Distribution.
Yeah, great. You know what? If people are keen to check it out, and it's a really nice price as well. It's got a broad age range, and if people listening to this think, hey, I wouldn't mind getting that, if you can pre-order, that'll really help you out.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, pre-order is so incredibly important, particularly for the comics market, the way the comics market is set up. So if you're able to, that would mean the absolute world to me.
Yeah, well, once it's out and it's been a success and you're planning on the second graphic novel, you have to come back and talk us through more and share more of the stuff that you've been getting into. So, Christoph, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks, mate.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Thank you to Christoph for being my guest today. To check out his graphic novel, Under Kingdom, I'll post a link over at the Big Squid Facebook page and on my Twitter account as well. Thank you to Jess for being our shiny Patreon subscriber for the episode. I hope you enjoyed the chat today, Jess. If you'd like to support us, but money is tight, a top review on Apple Podcasts helps people find the work that my friends and I are doing here. And I'll be back next week with the next Mission Impossible. That's right, Adam, Richard and I are digging into Mission Impossible 3. That's the third in the series, in case you weren't sure. Let's finish today with a quote from the legendary cartoonist Art Spiegelman. With any work worth its salt, you have to trust the author enough to take its measure. And if you apply too many preconceptions, you are not taking its measure. Until then.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.